Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. Well, last year, the most listened to podcast on Farm to Table Talk was with Joel Salatin. So it gives me great pride to start a new year with a new conversation with Joel Salatin of Polyface Farms. Joel, welcome to the table.
Thank you, Roger. It's great to be with you.
We should do this every year. And in fact, I'm going to make that a regular tradition if you're up to it. You know, Joel, as you point out, you're not a typical farmer. In fact, I remember when you started showing up on the scene that people were hearing a little bit about you. I had people that were asking me, who is this Joel Salatin? And I called different people, I don't know how many years ago this was now, and they said, oh, well, he does things a little differently. You call yourself a lunatic farmer, among other things. You've got the whole list of ways you describe yourself, but you apparently aren't very thin-skinned about the fact that people thought you were a different kind of farmer.
Well, no. And in fact, you know, I took on that moniker just for fun because, you know, you can either be disgusted or frustrated about the way people perceive you, or you can just embrace it and say, yep, I'm different. And so, my favorite and most requested speech titles right now over the last 3 or 4 years has been Heretics of the World Unite. And it basically, you know, shows, here's the deal. You know, 600 years ago, you would have been laughed at if you had suggested that the earth was flat.
Mm-hmm.
You would have been laughed at if you had suggested that there's not a demon of measles or a demon of mumps. It's actually, you know, there's viruses and bacteria and little, you know, actually living things in our bodies that we can't see.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, I could go down this path, but you see where I'm headed. I mean, and so it has really struck me since I've been on the brunt of this, you know, you're a nutcase for so long from the regular Orthodox community, is, you know, isn't it interesting to sit down and meditate and think 100 years from now, what is it that our maybe great-great-grandkids will look back at our generation and say, can you believe they actually thought, you know, fill in the blank, that we could grow nutrient-dense food with chemicals, or that sterile food would actually feed our microbiome, or that we could eat stuff that's unpronounceable and there wouldn't be any side effects. I mean, you know, or that we should actually raise animals in confinement factory farms. Who knows what they will laugh at us at that point and say. And so that's been kind of the basis of this idea of instead of being apologetic that we're heretics or weirdos, just embrace it. And I think setting it in that kind of orthodoxy versus heresy context actually gives a lot of not only humor but energy to those of us who have embraced the innovative edge.
Well, you know, that's great because that really gets into the other area I was going to ask you about. Because even though you're not a typical farmer, I mean, back home you do break a sweat doing some farm labor. I've you know, seen you interviewed, and at least it looks like you're all out sweaty and moving fences and stuff like that when you get a chance. But you do depend on a lot of help from your family members and employees and interns and fans and customers. But the other farming role is that I want to get at is that you're kind of farming the dreams. I mean, you speak and you write and you're doing a podcast like this and Farm to Table Talk, and you plant these seeds of ideas about farming and shopping and eating food and even politicking about food. Is that fair to cast you as a,
sure,
as a dream farmer?
Yeah, well, I say that I'm an idea salesman.
Yeah.
And you know, Stephen Covey in Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, which is, you know, just one of the best books in the world, you know, he pointed out that you have to start with the end in view. You have to build it in your mind before you can actually build it on the ground. You don't start with a house without having some visual conception of what you're looking for. Is it going to be a Cape Cod or a ranch style, or, you know, underground or whatever? And there's a tremendous amount of truth to that. And so one of the reasons that I, you know, kind of build these dreams in my presentations is because, you know, we have become a society of technicians. It's all about how do you do this? How do you do this? How do you do this? And we are not a society of prophets or poets. And mm-hmm. throughout history, the prophets and the poets have been the ones who actually, you know, created a moral compass to steer whatever the innovation of society was. And it's when the technical part of society essentially says, you know, you poets and prophets, you know, go hide in your cave. We're going to go this direction, which happens more than not. What that does is it actually creates innovation that we spend the next couple of generations trying to remediate the damages of that innovation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think it's really important to appreciate that. While I'm a great believer in innovation and technology and those kinds of things, I'm not a Luddite in any in that form. At the same time, I have a deep appreciation for the fact that we can innovate things that we can't morally, mentally, emotionally, or physically metabolize. I mean, a great case and example is the three-decade love affair we had, our scientific community had, you know, feeding dead cows to cows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 100 years ago, nobody would have thought of feeding dead cows to cows. Cows were herbivores, you know, and they should eat grass and stuff, and we wouldn't even have thought of that. But in the, you know, cleverness of our own minds here, we decided, hey, we could grow these things faster, fatter, bigger, cheaper. Doesn't matter consequences. If we can grow them fatter, faster, bigger, cheaper, then that's good. And so we began doing that, and we didn't have consequences immediately. You know, it looked good, looked great. Then 3 decades down the road, we have this big kind of, you know, global, oops, maybe we shouldn't ought have done that, you know. And we had bovine spongiform encephalopathy, also known as mad cow.
The only thing I think we need to not get everybody all panicking on that, though, in a way. I mean, when you talk about feeding dead cows to dead cows, I mean, we eat dead cows. You and I do. But they're kept in the refrigerator until we put it on the grill. And there are people listening that are already ready to click off because they don't eat dead cows. But most people still do. In the case of putting it in animal feed, there's been blood meal, bone meal, so forth. I mean, that's been there for a long, long time, I suppose.
Oh yes, and in fact, you know, omnivores. I mean, this is the whole deal. Omnivores, chickens and pigs. Yeah, that's why the mafia always has pig farms. You know,
no.
I tell our kindergarten visitors, you know, I tell these kids, hey, when we go to the pigs, they all want to scratch the pigs. I say, okay, we'll go in with the pigs. That's great, but keep moving. You know.
Yeah.
And so. So there is an order. My point is, nature offers an order. There is a template of order in nature. There's a way that soil
right.
is built and soil is eroded. There's a way that biomass is accumulated, and the way that biomass is degenerated. A way that the air is purified. A way that the air is not purified. And so we need to appreciate that while we might not understand all the nuances that we see, there is probably a reason why there is an order that we see.
Yeah. Well, and you talk about that order when you go out, and you're out a lot. I look at your schedule, and you're speaking here and speaking there, and you've been all over the world, literally, and delivering some of these messages. I just was on YouTube the other night, and I found Paul Theroux, who's a great travel writer, and he was talking about the difference between a tourist and a traveler, and the travelers kind of learn more about the people rather than just the sites, and then they learn more about themselves. So I'm curious, you're out so much, what do you take back from these? I mean, you're out and you're sharing your ideas, but what do you bring home? What sticks to the ribs when you're out and around and getting feedback on your ideas?
That's a great question. Well, obviously, I mean, on a very practical sense, I see new things. You know, I see things people are doing. I mean, when I was in Australia, I saw the New Zealand K-Line irrigation system, for example. We now have that here on our farm. There aren't very many farms in America that have the New Zealand K. It's totally in its infancy. I think there's one little dealer in Michigan nationwide, but this is a fantastic little system, and of course K stands for Kiwi, you know, K-Line irrigation. You know, another thing I saw in Australia one time was what I think is a huge breakthrough in cropping systems, which is called pasture cropping. There's a guy there named Colin Seiss, who is an Alan Savory disciple with sheep. He's got thousands of sheep, but he also grows small grains, barley, wheat, rye, oats, and he was looking for many, many years of a way to do this without chemicals and tillage, because both chemicals, fertilizers, and tillage are the fastest way to burn the carbon, burn the organic matter out of soil. And so he hit upon this idea of using animals essentially as, well, animals as a fertilizer and an herbicide, if you will, to weaken a perennial sod strategically for a short period of time, for just long enough to get an annual, like a wheat or barley or oats, planted in that sod, and then the grain crop grows. The soil is never tilled, it's never inverted, and it's never denuded, and it's never killed. So the annual grows up ahead of it, the grass and clovers and stuff stay underneath it and just kind of stay retarded in the shade. And then when you take the crop off, the grain crop, you have this, 12 to 14 inch high layer of nice thick grasses underneath it that's already there and never was killed. We've now done that at our farm with great, great effect. So these kinds of things, there are just, very, very smart, sharp thinking people all around the world. So sometimes I see myself as a bit of a pollinator, I'm just over here pollinating and take it over here, pollinate. And every place has something to contribute to the overall message. I mean, in the Netherlands, you can go to the Netherlands, they have raw milk dispensing machines. Like you go to an airport, you get Sprite or Coca-Cola or whatever. Well, shoot, in the Netherlands, you walk in, you put your euro in a vending machine, and a cup comes down, and you get raw milk, not pasteurized, not homogenized, raw milk straight off a dairy, fresh in a dispensing machine. Here, raw milk is illegal. And
yeah.
So I can bring this back to people fighting the good fight in our country and say, take heart. In the Netherlands, not only is it not illegal, it's actually sold in vending machines around.
Well, so tell me, when you travel across the country and around the world, like you were just saying in the Netherlands, what ideas would be, in internet speak, considered trending now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say probably the single biggest trend right now, and certainly in the developing, in the what we would call the first world, I hate to use that because it makes Africa sound like it's not acceptable, but in the highly developed nations of Europe, Australia, New Zealand, the U.S., Canada, Japan, the South Korea, the single biggest trend right now or problem in agriculture is the aging farmer. In Japan, the average farmer is 70. In the U.S., the average farmer is 60. In Great Britain, it's about 61. In Australia, it's like 58. But they're all in this 60-ish year range. And what that means demographically is that in the next 15 years, which is not very much, 15 years, 50% of all agriculture equity, that's land, buildings, machinery, 50% of all agriculture equity in all of these parts of the globe are going to change hands. Somebody's going to get that, whether it's by inheritance, purchase, or whatever. And that has never happened in any culture in history in peace. The only time that's ever happened in history has been in conquest. Now, I'm not suggesting we're getting ready to have conquest. What I am suggesting is that this is a brand new phenomenon in the history of civilizations that are relatively at peace to have this great a transfer of agrarian equity in that short a period of time. And so the people who are in the cities are desperate to know with this trajectory, well, who's going to grow our food? Is it going to be Monsanto, Chinese? Is it going to be a new generation of young people? I mean, this is what I want to see, is a new generation of young people who caress our ecological umbilical and bring us all nutrient dense, great food that actually grows soil and purifies the air and the water. And if that's the dream, then how do we make that happen? And so that's the single biggest common trend and denominator that I see everywhere that I go is this problem of succession.
We got to talk about that, because there's a lot of people with a dream and there's a need. So it seems to me you've got two of the important ingredients. I can't help but mention, though, that I remember hearing my dad talk about when he was in World War II in a foxhole in Italy, and dreaming that someday he'd come back and farm. His dad was a farmer, but he didn't have a chance to go back onto that farm. But when he came back after World War II, there were a lot of widows lived in town that had inherited their farms, and they were looking for people to farm on a sharecrop basis, 50-50 you give the labor and they do out of pocket and things like that, which I don't think happens much anymore. But it got a lot of young farmers started right after World War II that had some background. They didn't necessarily inherit it. But at the time, though, it was a lot cheaper to get in, too. I mean, it didn't cost that much to buy it eventually.
That's right. In fact, my mom and dad came to our place here in 1961. 61 was not right after World War II, but it was a lot closer than it is now.
Sure.
And it's important to appreciate that at that time, the land was that they bought the land for $90 an acre, and calves, stocker calves, weaned calves. We just take one item. I won't take corn. The
sure.
same thing would be true on any commodity, but just for sake of discussion, calves at that time were bringing $30 a hundredweight. That's $90 land, $30 a hundredweight for calves. That's a 3-to-1 ratio. Today that ratio is 58-to-1. It's not 3-to-1, it's 58-to-1. And so so people who were able, yes, I mean, I've run into many people who started in the time period that you're describing, from like 1947 to 1965, basically, 45 to 65, that 20-year period. At that time, you could actually buy land if you were, you know, if you were sharp at all, you could buy land and pay for it from the production from that farm. Today, the land has no relationship to its productive capacity, because land price is based on, you know, whatever the market will bear. And so we have a tremendous amount of e-money coming out of you know, the urban sector, and that is artificially driving up, well, you could call artificially, not, I mean, it's the fact. It's driving up land prices, and so the relationship, the historical relationship, the use relationship between the land value and its productive capacity has changed, you know, tenfold in the last 30, 40 years. That is the problem right now. That's the successional problem. If young people can't get in, old people can't get out. And so both generations are stuck in this whole, you know, access, which is one reason why I'm actually writing a book right now on the common threads of success for, you know, entering, you know, for new farms. And I'm on the chapter right now of mobile, modular, and management intensive, that when your equity, when your farm becomes mobile and the infrastructure is modular and your equity is management, those are all ways of entering as opposed to, you know, buying land. Now you can get into farming without buying land. So I think we are entering a new time, like post-World War II, where there's a lot of land available. There's a tremendous amount of land being abandoned as these farmers age out. Their kids don't want it. Kids are looking for somebody to run it. They don't want to be the ones to lose it that's been in the family for, you know, three, four generations. They don't want to farm it, but they don't want to lose it. And so there's a tremendous amount of opportunity, I think, for young people to get in, but they're not going to get in by building a Tyson chicken house or, you know, or growing whatever, you know, Roundup Ready soybeans.
I just have to mention that when we talk about barriers to entry, I just spoke to a farmer back in Indiana, and he knew of somebody that just purchased a combine, and you know how much he paid for it? It was nearly $1 million. I'm not kidding.
Wow.
You. I think it sounds like I'm making this up. But it was over $900,000 for a combine. So you started with the barrier just being land. And when you start looking at the scale with that traditional big, you know, conventional kind of farming, who's got the money for that?
Right. So what that means is that the way in now is not through the commodity door. The way in is through the craft door. And so the wonderful thing about the day we live in is that as the commodity sector of the farm and food world becomes more and more untrustworthy, that is what's driving everything from farmers markets to CSAs to on-farm marketing to what I call electronic aggregators, these internet sales. There are just a tremendous amount of alternative marketing venues now in our world, and of course one of the things that's facilitating those is the internet. Savvy farmers who are craft oriented are accessing their neighborhoods with, you know, social media, with their own narrative, to restore niches of trust, if you will, in the food system, where trust has become almost obsolete in the mainline food group food system. And this is so all these things, you know, these things move within the farm food sector, you know, as one closes, i.e. land, you know, land gets too expensive. Well, what opens up is market access, you know, and so fortunately, not everything doesn't close at one time. As one thing closes, another thing opens, and that's part of innovation.
Well, I imagine every place you go then, when you talk about this trend, every place you go, there's somebody sitting out there in the audience or reading your book or seeing you online or something that say, you know what, I wish I could do this. I wish I could be a farmer. I'm in a job that, you know, I'm working for this big company and they don't really care about my future and whether or not I'm going to be able to retire and things like that. And I wish I could be outside and have the satisfaction of being a farmer. I'll bet you've been asked that question more times than you could count. What's the first thing I do? Well, so what is the first thing they do?
Well, the first thing you do is you have to get experience. And experience, you know, unfortunately you can't Google experience. If you're gonna develop a skill, you know, the old 10,000 hours or 10 years deal, and that's very true. And so I always ask the question, well, you know, what are you doing now? You can't sit here and do nothing and expect that this dream is going to fall in your lap. You have to be taking steps now that move that trajectory forward. Now, if you're in a condominium in the middle of the city, then you know you can say, well, you're at a little bit of a disadvantage, but it doesn't mean the game is over for you. You know, what are you doing now? You can have a vermicomposting kit under your sink. You can hang. You know, you can hang trays outside your south wall and grow vegetables on the wall. You can put a solarium on your house. You can grow bees on the roof. there are a lot of things that people can do. My favorite story was a lady I ran into in Edmonton, big city, Edmonton. She lived in a sixth-floor condominium, had no money, no land, but she desperately wanted to farm. How am I going to do this? She knew one friend. She had one acquaintance. I'm not even sure how friendly it was, but she knew a lady who had a backyard. She went to this lady, and she said, would you please let me put a little vegetable garden so I can just grow something? I just want to grow something. The lady said, sure. So they took a little, you know, like a 12 by 10-foot corner there off the backyard, and sure, it's yours, you know, enjoy it. So she put in a garden. Well, as it grew, it was very beautiful, and the next door neighbor saw the garden. She went to the lady who owned the backyard and said, hey, do you think your friend would put a garden in my backyard? And so, well, I'll ask. You know, so she said, well, sure. You know, well, you can see where this story goes. I met this gal 18 months after launching her first backyard project. Within just a few months of launching that, she was farming almost, I think, 20 backyards. Her whole farm was a tool rack on her bicycle. She rode her bicycle from backyard to backyard. She had a part-time employee. It had grown so big. And she was farming full-time in the middle of an urban, you know, of a highly urbanized area with no land and no money, and she was full-timing it. So, you know, those are the kinds of stories of hope that you hear when you travel and you meet people. And so when somebody comes up to you and says, oh, man, I just don't know, the fact is that there's not a hopeless situation. There are just tougher and easier situations. And so, like this lady, you know, she didn't take no for an answer, and she just said, I'm going to take one step. There's no reason to plan 10 years down the road. We don't know what's going to happen 10 years down the road anyway. The question is, what am I doing today that will create a different trajectory for me? And if we do today what we should do, well, tomorrow will become more obvious, and in 10 years, our trajectory will be formed by all of the proper steps we took day to day to day to day.
Well, that makes so much sense. And the other thing, Joel, it seems to me that people start on taking those steps, and I've run into a few of them myself. They have to wing it on some things. I mean, oftentimes they've got to have some other source of income or take a part-time job, or, you know, they're putting some things together so that they can support themselves as they get up to size or capability or market demand.
Sure, sure. And I that wasn't my whole answer, but it was a starting point.
Sure.
I mean, you need experience, and so throw the TV out the window and take all that. The average American male right now, between 25 and 35 years old, the average American male spends 20 hours a week playing video games. Now, 20 hours a week playing video games on American males between 25 and 35, that's a lot of time. That could be spent learning a part-time craft, from woodworking to whatever. But, you know, at its most basic, you know, farmers are generally self-employed. They're kind of entrepreneurial. And our culture often does not encourage self-employment entrepreneurship. It encourages, you know, go get a degree and go work at the Dilbert cubicle for the man. And you know, maybe that's why 80% of Americans hate their jobs. So I would encourage people that you know, you need to look in the mirror and look at yourself and say, hey, am I ready emotionally and philosophically for a launch to do that? And then you simply start. You get out of debt, so you've got wiggle room financially. You create a nest egg. I tell people, put together 1 year's worth of living, so you can leave and you can live on your place for 1 year without any income. That's obviously a crash course. I call that jumping off a cliff. But that's kind of what Teresa and I did. Although we grew up here, I grew up here, and had a lot of already a lot of experience in farming. So the other thing, the other equity. So one equity is kind of financial, a little bit of a nest egg. Don't sink your ship on this. But on the second thing, start eating, drinking, and breathing farming. Go to sustainable ag conventions. Hook up with a local farmer in your church, your support, your civic club, whatever. Find somebody that you can take that time that you're not now going to the theater or watching TV or Little League or whatever, and take that time and develop some experience. And don't worry if the farmer is farming the way you want to farm. You know, 80% of what farmers do, you know, whether it's welding or fixing a gutter or how to back up a trailer or loading a cow or you know, picking corn, you know, all of these are skills that are not organic, non-organic. They're just basic farm knowledge. And so hook up with somebody, begin developing experience, and then do something yourself. If you have a backyard, fill it up. Fill it up with chickens and rabbits and vegetables and hoop houses and stuff. You have to put yourself into the tribe that is going to be your new tribe. And yes, it very well may be a 2, 3, even a 5 year transition. But if you don't start doing something today, 5 years will come and go, and you still won't have anything started.
Well, so, one thing I wonder about, Joel, is that there are institutions that are to be helpful. Extensions played a role in historically, and I think across the country, there's more and more county extensions that are starting to focus on helping local and creating food hubs and other things. But that also kind of leads into government, and I wouldn't be letting the cat out of the bag to say that you've been a critic of government, local, state, and national. And but they don't go away. What do you see as far as the potential role for government agencies, and what do you hope to see out of government agencies and their ability to wrap themselves around and hopefully help this trend along?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a great question, and there are certainly great folks in these government agencies, even what I would consider useless or unhelpful agencies. There are just stellar people in them. You have to look away sometimes, but you find good people. So the fact is, there are good people everywhere, and as you head down this path, what you're looking for are, you're looking for cheerleaders. You're looking for people who will encourage you. You know, one of the principles of this whole successful launch is surrounding yourself with a can-do spirit. And certainly a lot of the biggest critic often is your own family, if not your immediate family, your extended family that thinks, farming, you know, that's for dummies, and you can't ever make any money at it, and, you know, what'd you do? Do you have a midlife crisis? You know, what's your problem? And so you need, sometimes you need to distance yourself from these naysayers and find someone who, you know, who has that can-do. And often some of these extension agents and things will have a can-do spirit and can hook you up with the organizations. You mentioned the food hub. Food hubs are wonderful. Those are great. I hook you up with the CSAs, the made in your state, whatever your state is, all those kinds of things. But you need to put yourself in relationship with mentors and with other people that are, you know, that are attempting to do what you want to do. And I'm a huge believer in when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. And I think that when you place yourself in those places, you'll find it. All that said, I would not be honest to myself if I didn't tell folks that, yes, in my experience, spending a lot of time filling out grant applications and those kinds of things, you know, it sounds like easy money, but at the end, it actually ties your hands. There are a lot of things that you can't do. And so there is a reason why most, you know, really successful people were poor first, and because, you know, being hungry and poor makes you very, very creative. And you get a flush of a $10,000, $12,000 cash, and suddenly you got this little cushion, and suddenly you're not quite as creative as you were. So I think there's an advantage in being hungry and you know, scoping out all of your opportunities because you have to be creative, because if you're not, you'll starve. There are so many possibilities. I mean, if you're in, like I said, a church or a civic club or some sort of an organization that has structure to it, you know, offer to be their farmer. You know, hey, I'll grow your produce. Support me. I mean, that's the whole idea of CSA. But normally, it's the farmer going out and soliciting people. In this case, I'm looking at, you know, just starting right up from nothing, and there are people, for example, there are a lot of elderly people that are trying to stay at home. They have a little bit of acreage they want to stay on, and if you'll go and mow the yard and fix some dinners for them a couple evenings a week and do some house cleaning, they'll give you a free run of 10 or 15 acres. You know, well, that's enough in a craft farm to actually make a living on. And so I think there are just a lot of opportunities, and we need to be thinking about we can instead of we can't.
Joel, one of the things I think back of when I think of all the times I've heard you speak was seeing the movie Food, Inc. And in fact, when I've been involved with projects where we've asked consumers, when did you start thinking about these issues? And Food, Inc. comes up all the time. It was kind of a really made a mark, made an impression on many people, and there you were. I could argue that you were the most important person in the movie. What was strange to many of us is that Walmart was there too. And since then, Walmart hasn't really been the image that everybody thought they were aspiring to, that they, you know, it's a great big company trying to hold everything down. But you've seen them grow, too. I mean, it's one thing to talk about these trends, but what do you think of these companies, you know, like Walmart and the other big supermarkets and other food chains that seem to be committed to a new path? What do you think of that?
Well, what I think is that path has been clouded very much by what I call industrial organics. And, you know, it really struck me almost as an epiphany not long ago when I was doing a tour here at the farm, and somebody asked, you know, who's the biggest problem in our food system? And And without even really thinking, I said, the biggest problem is not Monsanto, it's industrial organics. Industrial organics has replaced, the bad guy. I mean, and Monsanto was easy to pick on because, you know, they were just didn't have much redeeming quality. But industrial organics, you know, these were companies that grew up small, and then they got taken over by great big, you know, global entities. And I encourage people, if you want to follow this story, you know, look at Cornucopia out of Wisconsin. Cornucopia, they're the watchdog, and they sue the USDA twice or three times a year, I think, where the USDA is not enforcing the organic standards. And so, you know, 99% of the organic eggs in the supermarket are not grown on grass. They're not grown in sunshine. They don't have any of the bucolic setting that is pictured on the egg carton. Rather, they're in a confinement house, and they're not that much different than anything else. And yet people, because they can get their oil changed and buy diapers at the same spot, they would get their industrial organic eggs, pay way more for them at Walmart, and feel really good about it. And what they're doing is they're leaving their local food sources, their little craft producers that are at farmers markets and CSAs and on-farm stands and that sort of thing, and leaving those for Walmart organics, which are coming from, as you mentioned before, you know, China, whatever, all over the world. There's no local sourcing, so there's no accountability, and this is creating a tremendous marketing issue in the local food movement. If you haven't watched the figures lately, farmers markets are flat, CSAs are flat. This burgeoning food movement that we all watched 5 years ago has essentially been co-opted and taken over by global industrial organics. And I can tell you, having visited the industrial organic farms that they're organic in name only, not in spirit by any means. And of course, the standards are being eroded every day, because it's the fox guarding the hen house. Why anybody thought that the government, who poo-pooed organics for many, many, many years, could actually come in as an arbiter of what and preserve what it actually means is beyond me. In debate, we call that intellectual schizophrenia. And so what we have is in the U.S., we have the National Organic Standards Board now, loaded up with great big company people. The farmers are gone from the board, and it's simply become a shill, if you will, for this sector. The whole word speak, clever speak, wordsmithing that's going on in the movement is really powerful. So the whole idea of know your food, know your farmer, get out there, do some sleuthing, and realize that chances are getting your oil changed and your diapers and your food at the same place might not be the place to get the best food.
Well, that's a good place to wrap it up.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.